From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dreitzer from New York and Mark Sloboda from Moscow. Welcome back. Here we are.
Here we are. Thanks, Don.
Thanks for having us, Don.
Yep. Okay, so Eric goes first this week. There's a whole lot to cover. Why don't you pick the first topic, and we'll roll it from there.
Oh, wow. Well, there is a lot to cover. You know, I think we left off last week talking a little bit about the controversy surrounding Saakashvili. Saakashvili's been in the news again. Interesting to note that what's happened in Georgia, what we talked about last week, if you didn't listen to the episode, was that Saakashvili is basically come out now that Saakashvili's involved in a conspiracy more or less to destabilize the government in Georgia and potentially to bring himself back to power. And the question that a lot of people have is, was Saakashvili involved in planning or potentially planning a Maidan type scenario in Georgia using the ownership of one of the most prominent TV stations as the pretext? It should be noted that this TV station a few years ago was more or less involved in a hostile takeover by Saakashvili's friend, Saakashvili's clique, and has been in their control ever since. And so this week we had a judge officially rule that the ownership, I believe 60% of the ownership of this TV station, must go back to the original owner. That is, it will be taken from Saakashvili's little buddy and given back to the original owners. Now, obviously, there is a significance to this that goes far beyond the ownership of a TV station. What this is basically a move against Saakashvili's power play in Georgia. This is more or less purging Saakashvili's crew from control of this TV station and, moreover, potentially opening them up to criminal prosecution. Now, I think that
more
this
criminal prosecution.
More criminal prosecution, and particularly for these people who, unlike Saakashvili, are not as closely tied to John McCain and the rest and won't just skip out of the country and become a governor in Ukraine. So I think that there is a significance here. I think we also need to keep in mind, too, that Saakashvili is currently in Ukraine.
He's a governor.
And in Odessa, as the appointed governor of that region, Saakashvili has made a lot of enemies as well. And one of the major enemies, and this went almost unnoticed, I think, this week, one of his new enemies now is Prime Minister Yatsenyuk. And isn't this interesting? They are now in a war of words publicly because basically they have been calling, more or less calling each other puppets. And I think that this is a very important let's call it division that exists within the Kiev oligarchy, the Kiev junta that controls Ukraine. And I think that this represents something very significant. Does this mean that Yatsenyuk has fallen out of favor with his U.S. sponsors, who seem to be still very much behind Saakashvili? Or does this mean that now the establishment in Ukraine is split over who they support, which factions they're supporting? There's a lot of internal dynamics going on in Ukraine right now, especially with the instability on Ukraine's borders. So I think that this is something that needs to be taken account of.
Let me point something out to you here, Eric.
It's going to have an impact on the future.
Let me point something out to you here, and then I got a question. If let's say you two guys are on one side of the negotiating table and I'm on the other. If I can create division between you, that operates to my advantage. So even if there were, you know, a unity of interest and a unity of opinion between those two characters. It would be in the U.S. as, you know, as the boss. It's in their interest to keep them at each other's throats. And look, I'll make a better deal with you, Saakashvili, than I'm doing with Yatsenyuk. Just give me a little more get-go, and you tell the other guy the same thing. I got a question. You have a foreign official that is a governor of Odessa in Ukraine, or whatever the hell that's called these days, calling for and meddling in some sort of a criminal uprising in another country, whether he's a national of it or not. Is that an act of war?
Not only that, but he happens to be a former tyrant deposed by that country and a wanted fugitive from justice.
But I'm looking at this. I'm looking at the state-to-state aspect of it. Is Ukraine committing an act against Georgia that could compel a military response from Georgia legally?
Are you asking me?
I was throwing that to Mark first, but I wanted to put that out there.
Militarily, no.
Yeah, like in other words, let's say the governor of
the international legal requirements for a military response are extremely high and almost invariably, at least technically, necessitate Security Council approval.
Unless it's absolute self-defense, like immediate self-defense. Yes. I understand. Yeah, however, here we go. We've got, let's say, the governor of Quebec, okay, calling for and organizing a coup attempt in Washington, and the government of Canada either is acquiescent or tacitly or actively supports that. Is that an act of war by Canada against the United States? That's what I'm asking about Ukraine against Georgia here.
Yeah, is it an act of war? Well, it's it could certainly be interpreted as interference in the political affairs, but it wouldn't rise to the level of an international act of aggression, particularly if it was stopped before it actually took place.
So now tamp it down.
The bar is so high for
Okay.
I mean, now, if that happened, the U.S. Certainly would just go into Canada and do whatever response to it.
Right.
You know, not being beholden by the Security Council as the U.S. feels it's not.
How about a response in kind by Georgia? In other words, hey, look, world, you see what they're doing here. We are now officially meddling in Ukraine, and we have, you know, legitimate reason to do it. They were meddling here.
I would be careful about that because Georgia is essentially a NATO client and Ukraine is a NATO client in waiting. So I think that ultimately this would be an inter-NATO row.
Okay. All right. So let's go back to where we were. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, Georgia is a they're the new government there is trying to walk a tightrope of both public opinion and international relations, and they certainly do not have the heinously animus, terrible relations with Russia that the Saakashvili regime did. But that being said, they're not Russia's friend, but relations have normalized to a large extent while Georgia continues to talk about the EU and NATO and so on, with the understanding that that's so far away from any reality that it's mainly, you know, just for political, domestic political reasons that it's still discussed.
Okay.
So Georgia's once again able to do trade and relations with Russia, which is crucial to their economy, particularly the export of wine, which is their biggest export by far, and which Russia is by far the biggest consumer of.
Oh, yeah. Is that important to Georgia's economy, or is that important to Sloboda's economy?
Well, Sloboda is a keen aficionado of Pinsmerule and many other such fine Georgian wines. The horticulture, the oldest horticulture in the world, according to some, and certainly by Sloboda's estimation, the best. Not that I am paid by the Georgian wine lobby to promote their products.
A travesty, I tell you. A travesty.
I should be.
Do they comp you at least?
Yeah, I should be. Seriously, if you haven't tried Georgian wine, please do. It's the best in the world.
Okay. Yeah, it is very good. I agree with that completely. I've sampled it in Moscow rather extensively, as a matter of fact.
As a Eurasianist, that is one reason why I never want to see Georgia outside of Eurasia, because we want that wine for ourselves.
Okay, the wine, all right. The wine and the cognac.
So, yeah.
And the food. And no, the cognac Armenian.
All right, so what else we got?
Cognac Armenian.
We also
Russian vodka.
Yeah.
Crimean champagne, Georgian wine, Armenian cognac.
Oh, yeah.
You're set.
Okay, let's go to the Vienna talks.
Sure. What do we want to talk about?
Well, what are they talking about at last report?
Well, I think that obviously the significance of all of this is the participation of Iran. The significance of all of this, I think, is the alleged shift in tactics by the United States and their growing willingness to engage in a negotiation of some sort. But, you know, call me cynical or skeptical or what have you, but I'm not really buying that exactly, because I don't think that the U.S. really is interested in a legitimate political solution, because, well, quite frankly, if they were interested in that, they wouldn't be acting the way that they are. For instance, the paralleling the beginning of the Vienna talks is the Obama administration's announcement of special forces going into Syria. Now, if you're serious about de-escalation and the creation of a ceasefire and, a halt to the conflict itself, you don't go ahead and inject your special forces into the battlefield. So I think there's that element. But what I do think that the U.S. is really doing here is essentially pursuing what could be called a dual track program. On the one hand, engaging in these talks in order to try to, let's say, improve their bargaining position. They also have these troops on the ground in the country for the purposes, and this is my own take here, for the purposes not of actually engaging in any fighting. It's a small force. Their purpose there is to provide command and control for these terrorist groups that are on the ground. They need to be directing them. They will be mobilizing them, perhaps providing them organizational support, logistical support, communications equipment, all the things that are necessary to take on a well-equipped adversary. So, in effect, then, the U.S., in attempting to, quote-unquote, resolve the conflict, has delved deeper and made this into a full-blown proxy conflict against Russia. And I think that that's really how it needs to be understood. Now, there is, of course, the added danger, and I want to hear from Mark on this as well. There is, of course, the added danger that when you inject these weapons and these special forces into the battlefield, what happens when one of these terrorist factions that have embedded special forces aid, what happens if they shoot down a Russian jet? Who actually brought down the jet? Did the rebels do it? Did the Americans do it? I think that it sets up a very dangerous potential for a political incident far exceeding, the question marks surrounding the Russian airliner that went down, because there wouldn't be quite so many question marks. It would be clear what happened, and then how would Russia respond?
Right.
And is such an escalation really, does that carry the potential for a regional war?
Yeah, I mean, you have these U.S. troops that, so let's say you have five of them embedded in a group, or in any event, proximate to a group that shoots down one of a squad of Russian planes. Do the Russian planes respond immediately to the fire, and are the American troops there, or the possibility of them, operating as human shields?
All right. You want me to jump in there?
Yeah.
All right. Let me start with the Vienna talks and remind me to go back to the special forces, because I have a little bit of some disagreement with Eric's assessment there.
Okay.
All right. So the question with the Vienna talks is, you have to ask yourself, is this actually going to lead towards any type of peace process in Syria? And the answer to that is, in the long term, yes. In the short term, no.
Right.
So the talks present a model whereby all the relevant regional and global powers are sitting around the negotiating table for the first time. China is even there, the United Nations, the EU, Iran, Iraq, even Germany, France, Italy, the UK, Jordan, everyone. Everyone is there except for the Syrians. Now, at the future date, this will be necessary to defuse and eventually resolve the conflict in Syria, which has become in equal parts a civil war, a proxy war, a global fight against jihadism, and a proto-World War III. Mm. That's what we're looking at now. The Vienna talks, we can call them Vienna II, it's the second round, have become kind of a modern version of the Concert of Europe in the 19th century. Mm. They're reflective of the emerging multipolar world order, with major great powers coming together to resolve their differences, with no single one of these factions clearly dominant or holding all the cards. So, crucially, I think the UN has been brought into the Vienna talks, and at some level, there must be the uncomfortable recognition that everything the West and its GCC allies are doing in Syria, from creating and supporting these rebels to airstrikes, is in violation of international law, while Russia and Iran are operating completely within the bounds and in support of international law. But in the short term, the talks have stalled and will remain frozen on the same principal fault lines that halted the earlier Geneva process last year. First, there is no agreement on the role of the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, what role he'll play in any political settlement and any transition process, as it's termed. There has at best been an agreement to disagree and put this matter off. Second, with no one group in clear sight of a military victory in Syria, all sides will continue the conflict into the medium term. They're jockeying for a position of strength through facts on the ground, which then they can impose their vision on the other players in a future settlement. Now, this is most clearly seen in the U.S. announcing it will increase arms to a newly branded rebel force that they're making up, the SDF, or Syrian Democratic Forces, that, as the New York Times has reported this week in their headline, exists in name only. It's primarily the Kurds. And for the first time, openly acknowledging its special forces on the ground in Syria. As a U.S. official mentioned, it's not like these are anything new. They've already been there. We're just admitting that they're there.
Or
announcing. They're that open about it. So they're thus keeping the potential to vastly escalate the situation through incremental mission creep. Also, the United States said very openly that they thought that it was premature for the rebels, the opposition, to speak to the Russian government, despite continually accusing Russia of bombing said rebels. This clearly indicates that the U.S. doesn't want this process to go far until they have achieved some semblance of facts on the ground to back up their position in negotiations.
Or till they find enough rebels to come to the table.
Yeah, they find some rebels to come to the table. Similarly, the flow of advanced TOW anti-tank missiles from the U.S. via Saudi Arabia to the now discredited FSA, acting primarily as a front for providing these weapons to the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra, and the U.S. sending A-10 close air support, as well as F-15C air-to-air combat aircraft to Turkey for use inside Syria, shows us that Obama is not resolved to take the off-ramp from the crisis that Putin has oh so graciously offered him.
Not to just to mention there, when you're talking about air-to-air combat capacity, ISIS and Al Qaeda do not have air forces. There's only one.
Yes, they're there for the Russian and the Syrian air forces. Right. The potential for a mishap or misunderstanding resulting in direct conflict between the U.S. and Russia's in Syria has not only not diminished through the Vienna talks and the deconfliction, but has never been greater. In the short term, perhaps, the most hopeful result to come out of the Vienna talks would be operational agreements reminiscent of the Cold War to avoid great power conflict in Syria. But in the end, the talks merely provide a format for an eventual resolution of the geopolitical nature of the Syrian conflict. They in no way provide for a domestic resolution. This is perfectly illustrated by the fact that the only Syrian in attendance at the Vienna 2 talks,
the waiter,
this is true, was one of the waiters.
Right.
So the 9-point Vienna 2 resolution, it asserts that Syria's unity, territorial integrity, and secular character must be held. Now, there's a problem with this because the vast majority of the forces fighting the Syrian government on the ground in Syria, from ISIS to Al-Qaeda to Ahrar al-Sham and the umbrella Islamic Army of Conquest, to even half of the Free Syrian Army brigades, do not and would not agree with these conditions. They're fighting for an Islamic caliphate or Islamic state under some degree of Sharia law. Joshua Landis said perhaps the only real issue is what degree of Islamic law, or he also said how long their beards are, which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah,
so this is the ultimate problem with resolving the domestic nature of the Syrian conflict, is that none of the actual opposition belligerents on the ground can ever actually be brought into an international negotiating room by the Western and GC powers backing them. Well, so we've got to conclude that the U.S.-West actions in Syria are so indefensible that the U.S. has to condemn or at least contradict them in any public forum, as they're in complete contradiction with declared U.S. policy in Syria and values. So until the U.S. and its allies find the political resolve and maneuver out of this contradiction, there could be no foreseeable end to this conflict.
Eric, let me ask you, Eric.
Kerry said that the Vienna talks represent the best opportunity for Syria to chart a course out of hell. This may be true, but first, the U.S. must take that path out of the hell they've had no small part in creating in Syria.
And they've got to give Syria a pen if they're going to chart anything.
Hang
on a sec, Eric. I want to ask you something. And first, I just want to throw this out. I wouldn't have eaten, if I were at the table there, I wouldn't have eaten anything brought out by that one Syrian waiter wondering what happened behind the doors in the kitchen. There's two things that Mark brought up that I want to go to. One is the fact that the acknowledgement of, this truth that existed before of American forces on the ground in Syria was actually an announcement of it. So that, once you had Russia's Air Force bombing these clusters of terrorists and everyone knowing that there were Americans, somewhere within some of them, the possibility of an American being killed in a Russian airstrike, of course, came into being. Now, if they were not there, quote unquote, officially, and that happened, that's one political game that plays out in terms of public relations after the fact. Now that it's been announced, however, it's an entirely different condition. And obviously that step was taken, knowing this and moving towards that goal. But here's what I want to ask. With the current climate and the current state of relations between the United States and Russia, and really the change in behavior of the United States beyond how it ever acted during the Cold War, at least after the first atomic explosion in Russia, can Russia trust any kind of big power deal that would avoid conflict from the United States? Can they trust them?
The short answer to that is no. The longer answer to that would be, I'm not sure who in the United States camp is really even able to give such assurances or to make such deals, because if you look at the conversations going on in Washington, I mean, it was just reported this week that I think it was the Senate Armed Services Committee and actually one or two other committees, which were literally discussing World War III. I mean, they were discussing operational readiness for a war with Russia. I mean, it was not, you know, oh, could the United States go to war with Russia? It was how many jets do we have? How many carriers do we have? What is their readiness to take on a Russian threat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that is, I think, illustrative of the sort of the tenor of the thinking in Washington now. There is an entire camp, if not consensus, that is so utterly deranged that they are literally contemplating a scenario of war with Russia. So if I'm Russia and I'm looking at that and I'm looking at what the Russians are so famous for saying, our American partners, and if I'm looking at my American partners holding these talks in Washington, I'm not so sure that I'm really willing to buy into any deals. Now, of course, these operational deals that Mark was talking about, those are very much on the table. The Russians are, of course, involved in those sort of talks. There was also this question of a ceasefire agreement coming out of Vienna. Now, it didn't happen, of course, but there's a very real question there. If the Russians and the Americans were able to sit down and to lead the path towards a ceasefire, what does that tell you about the nature of the forces that are on the ground? What does that tell you about the rebels and the terrorists and their relationship to the United States? I think that there are some very uncomfortable questions that come to the surface when you start picking at this question generally. Now, in regards to the U.S. and a potential deal with Russia, I think that there's more to this. And I do think that there are certainly elements within Obama's administration that desperately want to find a way out. But I think that Obama is unwilling to take it. And I think that the reason is because Obama is fear. Well, I think there's a number of reasons.
He doesn't want to get shot.
But I also think that Obama is cowardly. He's trying to set up his legacy, and he's afraid that those on his right, especially, and including Hillary Clinton, they have made him out to be a weakling when it comes to Russia, to have been outmaneuvered again and again and again by Putin, and that he's unwilling to concede in his mind. The issue of Syria. And I think that that plays into this. I think that also there is this fundamental point. I'll go back to a couple of weeks ago. We talked about it here on this program, that there is the deep state, and the deep state to which Obama is beholden, not the other way around. The deep state is not yet ready to let go of Syria, as we can see from all of the think tanks, as we can see in Foreign Affairs magazine, in Foreign Policy, and all of the establishment outlets. They're not ready to concede Syria. If anything, they're ready to carve it up. They're ready to carve up Syria, and you see it more and more, a change in language. I now hear people from Brookings and from these other think tanks talking about the formerly known as Syria, the country we used to know as Syria. Now, that is, of course, a reality on the ground, but the fact that they're saying that, I think, points to something far more significant. I think that the regime change of a single contiguous Syrian state is now dead. I think that their version of regime change is de facto partition. And I think that that is the direction. Yeah, that's their plan B. It is to carve up the country. It is very similar in a lot of ways to what was planned for Iraq and what they have achieved de facto, carving up that country into three different states along sectarian, ethnic, tribal lines. And I think that you're having the same thing happening in Syria. So That is what the U.S. is really pursuing. So when you're talking about a deal between the U.S. and Russia, they're at cross purposes. Their objectives now are completely different. Russia wants one whole contiguous secular Syrian state, stable, more or less status quo. The U.S. wants exactly the opposite. When their objectives are in such contradiction to each other, I'm not sure that I really buy into any quote-unquote deal.
Okay, Mark, go respond to whatever you want in there. And when you finish that, I want to go back to the part about the Russia versus the United States, because I want to talk about the Senate Foreign Relations Committee meeting and the prepping of the American public, basically, for a war with Russia.
Yeah, let me start with as an ex-military guy. Let me start with this 50-man special forces team. Of course, right. And whenever you're providing a number like 50, we can immediately disregard it as just a benchmark for the press, right. Not as any reality on the ground. And as we've already discussed, these special forces have already been there. The U.S. has openly admitted to operations in Syria before. And we have to remember that whatever they're doing, they have no mandate no legal mandate from either the Security Council or for the UN-recognized Syria government to be doing whatever it is that they are doing in Syria. Now, 50 men, 50 special forces is not a force multiplier. It is not enough to coordinate airstrikes. It is not going to change any facts on the ground. You could say that it is a bare minimum, the absolute, probably below the bare minimum required for Obama to save face after the Russian intervention, because Obama is under fire from both the political hawks and from the deep state, in the Pentagon, in the CIA, in the State Department. His chief Russian advisor left the administration in the past few weeks, and she has come out publicly and said, well, she still maintains that it wasn't her reason for leaving, that she wanted Obama to take a much harder line on Russia. We have to admit that perhaps Obama's weakness, such as it's called, may be one of the only things keeping the U.S. and Russia from a direct conflict at this point. Right. So why are these 50 special forces there? All right. We'll go back to the if they're there in a second. But there are special forces of some number in northeast Syria in the Kurdish region. Are they there to lead the forces of the Kurds to liberate Raqqa? No. Okay. Well, you could say they're there as human shields to protect these forces, but the Russians and the Syrians have no interest in bombing the Kurds, right. Because the Kurds are fighting ISIS, have been all along, and have never fought the Syrian government. In fact, Assad, under pressure, of course, but devolved authority, basically granting them autonomy to run their own affairs.
Are they there to keep Erdogan from going too crazy?
They are there. These 50 special forces are there to prevent a complete Russian-Syrian-Kurdish alliance. They are there to keep the U.S. in the game at that table with the pretense of having some forces on the ground. With these U.S. special forces there, and you can bet that money and arms will be accompanying it, the U.S. is now trying to claim the Kurds as their force. Now, how the YPG will respond to this, they've proven very willing in the past to take aid from whoever offers it and then work in their own interests, and I expect them to do that in the future. But that is why these special forces are there. They're there to stop, because the Russians were very actively working to bring the Kurds into this coordination room of intelligence and military, and the U.S. does not want the Kurds fully reconciled with the Syrian government. Now, there's a question of these so-called the number of 50 special forces. We know there's special forces there in the northeast Syria, but very quietly, there was reported in the Lebanese press, Al Mayadeen, and it was picked up by Russian media, Sputnik and RT, that there are U.S. special forces, that these trainers have arrived, not in the de facto Kurdistan, where we already know they are, but in Sudan, in Latakia, in western Syria, in the bit of the Alawite heartland that the jihadi forces have managed to seize. This is a huge provocation. One, it's again directly contesting the Syrian government, because ISIS is not in Latakia, and the only one there for them to fight is the Syrian government. Second of all, the Russian air base is in Latakia. So if this is true, and the U.S. is putting special forces into Latakia, and I'm saying if, because I've only seen this one report so far, and I haven't seen it verified. But it's crazy, huge provocation. It's also incredibly stupid, because they're still not going to change anything, whatever number of special forces. And I don't think Obama is going to use these as an excuse to later increase numbers dramatically through mission creep incrementalism. But the next president may very well do that.
Right. Can I say that I was just going to add basically what Mark was getting at, namely that the public announcement of these special forces, and of course we know that they were there, but now it's sort of publicly acknowledged, and that is markedly different. Now that there's
– that is a precedent. That is an important right.
Exactly.
Precedent in the erosion – further erosion of Syria's sovereignty.
Right. Well, and also I think it could be interpreted as a means of forcing the escalation from a president who may not be willing to escalate entirely, because I think it's quite obvious that Obama is, let's say, less hawkish on the issue of Syria than a lot of the people around him. Less enthusiastic, maybe a better way to say it, because he's certainly a bloodthirsty warmonger, there's no doubt. But yes, less enthusiastic about it. And I think it could be seen as a means of forcing either Obama to escalate by now acknowledging this, or possibly putting in a scenario where no matter who the next president is, including Uncle Bernie Sanders, that the U.S., including, obviously, but I mean, I say it with humor, that forcing this situation to be escalated, because once they're there, no president is going to just hang them out to dry. And I think that there is an element of this, and I return to this deep state issue. This is one of the ways in which the deep state, that is, the elements of the institutions of power that do not change administration to administration, this is one of the ways that they're really behind the driver's, in the driver's seat, behind the wheel when it comes to Syria, because this is clearly and unmistakably an escalation designed outside of the White House.
Okay, now, here's something I want to probe a little bit. You know, we learned in the last years that during the entire time of the mid-40s, for the post-war period and even before the end of World War II, that the United States was contemplating a nuclear war on the Soviet Union and was building the weapons to do it, and it was the explosion of an atomic weapon in Russia that stopped that. In other words, they can shoot back. While that was going on, the Cold War was constructed and implemented. And it appears in hindsight that one of the primary targets of the Cold War was the American public, to prepare them for a war with their just recently ally. I'm looking at the machinations around Syria and around Ukraine, the test firing of anti-missile missiles in Europe, the provocations in the South China Sea, all of that, as a moving forward of forces, among other things, and the testing of the hardware, and wondering if the hearing that took place this week where Russian propaganda, quote unquote, that is information coming to the American public through RT, Sputnik, other news agencies, is a threat to their effort to conduct a war with Russia that they plan to do, or that they're leaving the option open to do, and that they're looking now to start preparing the American public for that. What do you guys think of that?
Well, I think that there's no doubt that there is an element of conditioning happening here. I think that there's a couple of things to keep in mind here. Number one, this is how an empire acts when that empire is no longer a political hegemon. Okay, in other words, the United States has military power. It has a tremendous amount of military power. And up until now, really up until this Syria conflict, the United States was able to more or less have unanimity in terms of its exercise of political power. It was able to impose its will politically wherever it saw fit because of its not only because of its military, but just because of what the U.S. means symbolically, its stature. And I think that the fact that they have lost that form of political hegemony, as we saw in Ukraine, as we see in Syria, as we've seen in a number of other places as well, because they've lost that, they're growing increasingly belligerent. And I think that in addition to that, there is probably also a psychological, and social element to this. I don't think you would have seen anything like that level of conditioning in the public in, let's say, a previous generation, especially among people who lived through a world war. I think that a lot of these people in Washington have absolutely no concept of the gravity of what they're talking about in terms of a potential military conflict with Russia and or China. And that's what is so frightening about it, quite frankly, is because as I sit here in New York City, to me, when I hear talk of a potential military conflict with Russia, I hear more or less what sounds like the end of the world. And I think it's incredibly terrifying. It's strange Lovian in the worst sort of way. And I think that also it is a control of information and the flow of information that the U.S. has. The U.S. and the West still really does have control of information. It's just not 100% dominant the way that they once were. I think that that really also terrifies them, because they understand that the only way that their hegemony is maintained is through the consent of the people in whose name they rule. And ultimately, more and more people tuning out of Western media and tuning into non-Western media and alternative media certainly threatens that monolithic sort of system that they've created. So yeah, it's terrifying. I saw this reported in a couple of news outlets, and if you read some of the quotes from some of these officials in these Foreign Relations Committee and other ones, I mean, it is just mind-boggling how insane these people really are.
Mark?
Yeah, Eric talked about the U.S. losing political hegemony. It's also losing, this just builds on what he was saying, narrative hegemony. And this is when we've seen Western leaders, propagandists in the media say that the Russians are living in a completely different reality. Well, the reality seems to be extremely subjective here, because I'm immersed in we're all immersed in the media from all over the world. The three of us here monitoring it, and I certainly don't agree with their narrative. I think that we are already in the midst of the early stages of a global conflict. And I don't want to call it a Cold War, because there's an element of ideology to it, it's more a question of world order and national interest in geopolitics than ideology. The ideology is a secondary aspect of it. Although the when I say ideology, I mean values as well. That exists as well. But we are in a great power conflict. We're focusing right now on the info war aspect of that conflict, although it extends into the cyber, the space race, the proxy wars, the financial. It extends into almost all spheres at this point. And it's the West, led by the United States, against not just Russia, but China and Iran as well. And there are multiple flashpoints. We never seem quite to touch on the South China Sea, but that is in many ways even more dangerous, what's going on there. And we really have to touch on that in detail at a future time. We're talking about propaganda and the preparing the American public for this type of war in a hot war through the demonization of Russia. Over this crashed airliner, this Russian airliner, A321, coming back from Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, a place in Egypt, 70% of their tourists in these locations are Russians. Russians love these resorts on the Red Sea. They were coming back to St. Petersburg. The plane crashed shortly, just 20 minutes after takeoff. And very quickly, before any investigation, before even all the materials were even collected, the U.S. and the U.K. were placing the blame on terrorism. And Russian and the Egyptian government said, well, we don't want to jump to any speculation or conclusions. We have to consider everything. It's an investigation. No, the U.S. and U.K. insisted it's terrorism. Then they went one step forward and said it's a bomb. Okay, so that seemed likely. It seemed unlikely that it could have been shot out of the sky by any of the militants on the Sinai Peninsula. Don't have anything. They can shoot anything down at 30,000 feet. Right. Then they insisted that ISIS was involved, which is another further step. Interesting, because ISIS has never engaged in this type of terrorist attack before. They've been focused on seizing and holding land and establishing their caliphate. So it's a big change. Now, there is some ISIS local branded affiliate that has claimed the attacks, but almost every expert disregarded this almost immediately. They didn't provide any specifics of the case. And the U.S. Has said that they've received info on this via chatter and intercepts. Right. Now, read the CNN report that came out just yesterday, and you will see when they are pressed on this, they quickly acknowledge that what is the source of this chatter?
What?
Social media.
Right. There you go.
It's social media.
It's on Facebook. It must be
militants
true.
Bragging after the fact. Right. And that is the open source information, they say, is what has provided the status for the U.S., and the UK to claim so definitively before any investigation that an airline crash in another country with no American or British citizens on board that they have to stick their nose into was a terrorist attack, and say who did it based on open source information collected off the internet. The US president and the British prime minister themselves personally attested to this in public at the presidential level. It's amazing.
And then we come
to the Washington Post this morning, put out an editorial. This is the DC paper of record. And at the very end of it here, they say the state media controlled by Mr. Putin and Sisi have a nasty habit of blaming all disasters on the United States, no matter how far-fetched the theory required. So we won't be surprised if Russians and Egyptians are told the CIA is somehow responsible for the tragedy in the Sinai. Those seeking a more rational conclusion must consider this somber point. The Egyptians and Russian regimes are far less adept at fighting terrorism than they are at lying. And that the headline of the article is, Russian and Egyptian officials are not to be trusted over airline crash. So the question is, we add all these facts together, what is going on? What is leading to this preemptive assault on whatever the Russians might and Egyptians might say about their own airline crash? I find this all very bizarre, very suspicious, and it all plays into this propaganda war we're discussing.
You know, I thought when I first saw that, I mean, obviously the first thing I thought of was the CIA did it.
I want to say that right off the bat, I don't think that ISIS did it.
Right.
I don't, because it's not in their MO, it's not in their local capabilities of right. their franchises.
All of that.
I don't think the CIA did it, because they're usually not so crude as to go after at least a nuclear power like that. But the Saudis, the Qataris, these firm U.S. allies, they are that crude. And they are very, very, very pissed at Russia. And they might want to send just such a warning.
Wow.
Now, that's pure speculation.
And how far off?
As long as Obama and Cameron are wildly speculating, I feel perfectly free to do so.
I'm just saying, you know, how far off the leash, though? That which is the question that I ask, which is why I say, assume the CIA's in it. How far off the leash are the Saudis and Qataris, really? But look,
they may be trying to cover for that now.
Yeah, that's true too. You know, there was an additional step that was taken, and that not only that it was ISIS, but it was done in retribution for. The intervention of Russia in Syria.
Which completely ignores the fact that the U.S. and U.K. have been supposedly bombing ISIS for over a year. That's
Without
the most ridiculous thing
right.
about that nasty little piece of shade.
Let me also add, there's a social dimension to this and context within which the Washington Post and these other media outlets were propagating this, what Mark was just talking about. You know, Sisi just visited the UK. And on his visit to the UK, there was a major propaganda push, not only in the streets but and in the media, but also from Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, basically condemning Sisi as a dictator, condemning Sisi's actions, and condemning the UK for meeting with Sisi. And then combination, you understand Sisi, unlike his predecessors, is a much closer friend of Russia than any other Egyptian leader since Nasser. That Sisi has signed a free trade agreement, although the status of that is somewhat up in the air, but a free trade agreement, initial agreement with the Russians and the Eurasian Economic Union. The fact that Sisi is fighting a war against the Libyan-based ISIS terrorists who are being led by the U.S. CIA proxy Abdel Hakim Belhaj, that he's also fighting a war against the Muslim Brotherhood, and that these are some of the reasons why Sisi and Putin and the Egyptians and the Russians have moved closer together. Because, of course, Egypt's heavy reliance on U.S. military supplies, U.S. military material has meant that Egypt has been more or less in the pocket of the Pentagon and the U.S. military establishment for a number of decades. And so this shifting that you've seen of Egypt under Sisi increasingly towards Russia is part of the reason why the Washington Post finds it necessary to rope the two together and to lambast them and to sort of make it out like they're the new axis of evil or something like this. I think that the reality here is that what they're trying to do is they're trying to use this A321 incident to make a larger propaganda and geopolitical point, and a point to Egypt that you better get it right, you better come back into the fold, a message to Russia potentially as well. And I think that ultimately that's part of the narrative here, and I think it's unfortunate unfortunate that we find ourselves in a scenario where Sisi, who has committed atrocities, who has used brutality, but Sisi is also fighting a very important theater of this larger war. He is fighting the Muslim Brotherhood, backed by Qatar, backed by forces in the Gulf. He's fighting against ISIS and Al-Qaeda infiltrating into Egypt from Libya along a very porous border. He's fighting an internal domestic war against the Muslim Brotherhood machine, and Sisi cut off any flow of weapons and terrorists from Egypt to Syria. So there is a complex regional dynamic within which we have to understand this broader regional conflict here, and Russia's role in it is, I think, very, very, very significant. We should not underestimate the importance of Egypt potentially moving out of the U.S. orbit and into the Russian orbit. That changes the dynamic for the whole region. Egypt is the key to the Middle East and the Arab world, as every quote-unquote orientalist has known for 150 years.
Go ahead.
Okay, you got about a minute and a half, Mark. What does Sisi and Putin have in common? What's pushing them together? The thing that's pushing them together, and I don't want to talk about the nature of Sisi's regime at the moment. I've got lots to say about that. He's a brutal autocrat. But from the Russian point, very realist point of view, he's a very necessary autocrat, because the experiment of giving the Egyptian people, the majority of whom are rural, uneducated, and religiously conservative, meaning Salafist, results in a Muslim Brotherhood government, which no one was entirely thrilled about. Now, we can talk democracy all day long, the principles involved. The one thing that Putin and Sisi have in common is a principled fight. Russia extremely consistent about that. Russia doesn't go around the world spreading democracy or its system or anything. Russia is opposed to Salafism, a aggressive Islamist, Sunni Islamist form of government anywhere in the world that it's found. And we can call it jihadism, terrorism. They're practically synonymous with Salafism. While the U.S. has proven and its allies have proven that they are willing to fight it or use it for their geopolitical interests, which almost inevitably results in backlash and chaos for everyone involved, including themselves, and they don't seem to have learned this lesson. So that's what is pushing Russia and Egypt closer together at the moment. But we shouldn't overestimate the Egyptian militaries, and it is just a continuation of the Mubarak military regime with a different head at the face that has carried on for so long. If I was Russia, I wouldn't place too much geopolitical weight on Egypt, as we've seen it flip back and forth before. And this military regime is still very much dependent on U.S. military and financial aid.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there, guys. Thanks a lot. A pleasure as always. Looking forward to it again next week.
As always. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys. You've been listening to CPR Sundays with Eric Dreitzer and Mark Sloboda. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.